from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In the 1990s, Harvard's Robert Putnam took the spotlight with a big book on how America's old community ties were breaking. It was called Bowling Alone. Now, Putnam is out with a big new take on American life, even more anguished. It's called Our Kids. It's about soaring American inequality is cutting American children off from the very basics of opportunity. The American dream, he says, has become a birth lottery where everything depends on who your parents are. This hour on Point, Robert Putnam on the now stark opportunity gap facing America's children. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you see the gap? How do we fix it? And what if we don't? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Robert Putnam, professor of public policy at Harvard University. He's consulted for Presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, wrote the 1995 best-selling Bowling Alone. He's out today with a big new book titled Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Robert Putnam, welcome to On Point.
Thanks very much, Tom. It's good to be back.
Take us to the sort of baseline of your investigation here, and it turns out to be your hometown.
That's right, Tom. I grew up in a small, ordinary town on Lake Erie in Ohio called Port Clinton. It was this was the 1950s. It was a kind of Lake Wobegon. On Lake Erie, no very rich kids, no very poor kids, not very well educated. Almost half the parents of my classmates had not graduated from high school. So this is a pretty modest little town. But now looking back, more than 50 years later, we've surveyed all the surviving members of my graduating class to see how they did. And they did remarkably well. About three quarters of us ended up with more education than our parents, ended up with better economic prospects, and we've lived a really good life. And some of us that started at the bottom have done really well. A couple of black kids in the class who were, of course, facing, in Port Clinton, this is the 1950s, they faced racism and racial prejudice and so on. Nevertheless, they came from homes where no one had gotten past the third grade ever. They both graduated from high school. That was a big deal. They both went to college, even bigger. They both graduated from college, even bigger. They both went to graduate school. They both ended up with graduate degrees. That kind of upward mobility from near illiteracy in their parents' home to, you know, a graduate degree and a successful professional career, amazing upward mobility. It's a tribute to their own grit and their own native talents. They overcame racism. I'm not for a second trying to hide the racism in Port Clinton in those years, the cross burnings and so on. Nevertheless, their class origins, and indeed the class origins of all the kids in my class in the 1950s, did not impede their opportunity to pursue the American dream. If you go back to Port Clinton now, as we did in the course of doing this research, we find that Port Clinton has been utterly transformed. And I use Port Clinton as the starting point because I think it captures in this one little drop of water, you can see all that's happening in America. You can see the declining prospects for working class America as all of the factories in town closed down and the economic turmoils and troubles of the 1970s and 80s led in turn to changes in culture in Port Clinton. So the single-parent family rate, which had earlier been among the lowest in the country, is now nearly half the kids in Port Clinton are living in single-parent homes. And when we talk to some of these kids from Port Clinton, now working-class kids, they are living lives that are unbelievably different either from working-class kids in Port Clinton in the 1950s or, and this is the part that makes it so poignant to me personally, living lives completely different from my own grandchildren. My grandchildren are grandchildren of Port Clinton, and there are other people's grandchildren from my years in Port Clinton who are living almost unspeakable lives, and that is not – I'm proud of my grandchildren, but they made one lucky decision. They chose great parents, and they chose really terrific grandparents, and by that I mean well-educated. And so the story of Port Clinton is a story in which we've moved from a society in which we had a decent shot at the American dream. All kids had a decent shot at the American dream now to then, I mean, to an America in which that's frankly no longer true. And meanwhile, in Port Clinton now, there's immense poverty, but also along the beautiful shores of Lake Erie has grown up effectively a gated community that is 20 miles long and about 150 yards deep with million-dollar mansions. And those kids and the poor kids in Port Clinton attend the same Port Clinton High School that I attended. If you go to the parking lot of the Port Clinton High School now, so the school administrators tell me, you can see parked next to each other BMW convertibles driven to school by the kids whose parents live in that enclave along the shore, parked next to jalopies, junkers, mm-hmm. which kids live in. There's a street in Port Clinton called East Harbor Road. If you drive down East Harbor and you look to the left toward the lake, that census tract has virtually zero child poverty. But if you look to the right, to the other side of the road, that census tract has 50% child poverty. Port Clinton is partly a Rust Belt story, but it's not only a Rust Belt story. And in the other stories in this book, we go to Bend, Oregon, and Orange County, California, and Atlanta, Georgia, and Philadelphia, and Boston, and Austin. This is a nationwide trend, and we also try to pull together some data that shows just how wide this opportunity gap has grown over the last 30 or 40 years.
Robert Putnam, one thing that struck me so immediately in the book is you're a social scientist, a very prominent one, and yet when you really dug in on this front of inequality and its implications for children, there's a lot in here that you found shocking, even from your relatively well-informed perch. For people who may not be exposed, may not be out there doing the kind of field research that you've done for this book, Our Kids, what is it that the affluent that you may talk to in your circles, what is it that they don't see and they don't get about what's going on?
Tom, there are two big social trends that form the backdrop to the things that we're seeing with kids across America. The first is often discussed in America nowadays. It's the growing economic income gap between rich folks and poor folks, and that is certainly playing a very important backdrop role in explaining this opportunity gap that affects kids. But another important trend that's a little less widely discussed but is well known to social scientists is that over the last 30 or 40 years, we've seen increasing class segregation in America. Racial segregation and religious segregation are way down in America now, but over the last 30 or 40 years, we're now less likely to have neighbors near us who come from a different socioeconomic background. We're less likely to go to school with kids from a different socioeconomic background. We're less likely to marry people from a different socioeconomic background. And what that means is that our circles of acquaintances and friends and people that we know and our family and so on are all more concentrated among people like us. And that's true for people down at the bottom. Their connections are more concentrated among other poor people, and it's certainly true for those of us up near the top, well-educated, well-off Americans. Our connections are much more intense now than they used to be, concentrated on folks like us.
I read you
and
saying,
when I say
yes, please.
Rich, go ahead, Tom.
I read you saying that you didn't fully realize what the headwinds were that faced those kids because of that class segregation. Maybe others don't as well. Maybe they're still thinking, yes, maybe they're not born with all the advantages, but come on, bootstraps, pull yourself up. Generations did it before.
Yeah, Tom. In fact, as I say in the book, that to some extent describes me. I was shocked when I went back to Port Clinton. I mean, I didn't come from a destitute background, not at all. I came from a basically lower middle class background. And I've done pretty well in life, and I thought, you know, I did it, and you know, if other kids from a similar background today, you know, if they have enough grit, they can do the same thing. And what we found is that's just not true anymore in Port Clinton or anywhere in America. And that is the personal shock. You're absolutely right. I was personally shocked by this. I probably am a social scientist. I probably should have recognized what was more happening down in the lower third of American society. When I say rich and poor, by the way, in this book and in our conversation here, I don't mean Bill Gates and some homeless person. I mean the upper third of American society. That's the college-educated, college graduates in America. That's the upper third. Mm-hmm. That's you and me and many of your listeners, no doubt. And the lower third, I'm just talking about people who didn't get past high school but are maybe high school graduates. And that's the gap I'm talking about between relatively well-educated and well-off people and relatively less well-educated people. And the gap, the growing gap, is between those, the kids from those two kinds of backgrounds.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a big, urgent case that America's children are in serious trouble with. Harvard heavyweight social scientist Robert Putnam. He says stark inequality of opportunity for kids is now deeply shadowing our country's future. He writes it up in a big new book. It is called Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Joins us from New York. Robert Putnam, many callers for you. Mary Ellen in Alkaloo, South Carolina. Mary Ellen, thank you. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom. Urgent, it doesn't even cover. This is an alarm bell. I see a correlation between what you're discussing and what has gone on for an entire generation in the Mideast. Young people are full of passion, and when they see a dead end, they have no way to get a pride in personal work or put food on the table for possible families of their future. They turn their passion to something that's short of anarchy. It is anarchy. We are a nation of ethnicity. And if we are full of passionate young kids who have no way to move forward, we can see a very bleak future and perhaps anarchy.
Mary Ellen, I appreciate your call. Robert Putnam, you are not putting this case forward to encourage despair. Quite the contrary. You're saying very explicitly you hope this becomes a major issue, opportunity for America's children in the 2016 presidential campaign. But pick up Mary Ellen's challenge, her fear that if the country doesn't address this, the implications could be dire. What do you say?
Well, I appreciate Mary Ellen's insights and experience. I do think, as she said, that living in a country where, you know, a third of the kids don't really have any prospects is not an attractive future. But I want to emphasize that this is not just a fear for a kind of anarchic violence that drives my concern. Opportunity for our kids is not a zero-sum game. That is, it's not that maybe we should help these kids even at the expense of hurting our own kids. This is the sense in which I say there are no villains, Tom. In context, what I said was that the parents of the well-off kids are not the villains. There are absolutely, as I say, important causes, in that sense, villains. The fact that we on the opportunities upside of that gap are not taxing ourselves enough to pay for better education, special education, and so on for people lower on. So I'm not saying there aren't causes. Absolutely there are causes, and we can talk about those later. But the main point I want to make is the risks that are posed, and that's what Mary Ellen was asking mm-hmm. about. The risks that are posed are not only risks to our stable democracy, there are threats to everybody's national prosperity. The data make very clear that if we don't invest and support these poor kids, our own national growth rate will be substantially lower. And not because we're going to have to pay welfare payments to these kids. Even if we harden our hearts and don't pay any welfare to them, there's going to be substantial increased costs for the criminal justice system. There's going to be substantial increased costs to pay for the ill health that these kids are inevitably going to suffer as they get older, and there's going to be costs to the productivity of our national economy. So my own grandchildren, who are on the upside of the opportunity gap, will be worse off if we continue to fail to invest in these poor kids. It's not a case where we've got to choose, do we want to have help one set of kids or not help another, and not help another set of kids. It's, don't we need the contributions of all of our kids as we go forward in the 21st century?
Speak to Mary Ellen's fear, though, about democracy itself. I mean, there always is the hope, as long as we have a vibrant democracy, a functioning democracy, that this will self-correct, that we'll fix it. But do you see a threat to American democracy itself if we don't fix the opportunity gap for children? How would that unfold, unspool?
Well, the way it unfolds, and I talk about this in the book, Tom, the way it unfolds is not that, you know, tomorrow there are going to be peasants with pitchforks marching on rich enclaves. Mary Sue is one of the young women that we talked to in Port Clinton, or Lola, another young woman we talked to in Orange County. These people at the moment are very apolitical. The characteristic, the distinctive characteristic of these poor kids right now is that they're very isolated from everybody, from their parents, from the schools, from the community. They feel really disconnected. And in the short run, their political apathy kind of puts a damper on the fears that they may be, you know, engage in anarchic violence. The problem is, and I'm now going back to some famous social scientists of the mid-20th century who looked at the Nazi experience, and they said the problem is people who are disconnected don't necessarily stay disconnected. In a crisis, that apathetic mass can turn out to be quite volatile, and that's then leads into the scenario that Mary Ellen is talking about, a scenario in which this mass of disconnected people becomes a serious threat to stable democracy. I don't see that happening in the next 5 years, but if we don't do something about it, I do see that down the road.
Fix it or face economic and political consequences. John in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Robert Putnam.
Thank you for taking the call. My point is, families are having children, and they can't support those children. I would suggest that before people have children that they can't support or provide a good quality of life for those children to ensure that they do get a good education, that they do have enough food, that they do have a social environment that they can prosper, that's where I see the problem.
You mean don't have kids unless you can support them, you're saying, John?
Well, you know, that sounds harsh, but in reality, that's reality.
But does that mean that the poorest third of our fellow citizens should not have families, one-third of the country?
No, I'm not suggesting that, but that one-third of the population shouldn't have children, an abundant amount of children. In other words, they should have one child, two child, to ensure how could they possibly have children if they know in advance there is no way that they can support that child.
John, we've got it. Robert Putnam, your response.
Let me step back just a second, Tom, because I think John is actually raising an interesting issue. This problem of the opportunity gap is what I call a purple problem. That is, parts of the problem you actually can see more clearly through red conservative lenses, and parts of the problem you can see much more clearly through blue progressive lenses. And John is using red conservative lenses to highlight a particular part of this, which is the number of kids who are being born out of wedlock among poor Americans. I'm willing to join John in being critical of those parents. Indeed, the poor kids we talk to are critical of their own parents. So it's not a matter of saying, you know, parents don't have responsibilities here. But two things you have to add to that. First, remember, these very parents are the people who have not had a raise in 30 or 40 years. And many of them, the parents I'm talking about now, despite all their best efforts, can't get a steady job, can't get themselves moved toward a stable economic situation. So we shouldn't And as you say, Tom, I mean, just we can't say, well, you know, you've got to have a and before you can have kids, you've got to have a license, and the license costs a certain amount, and the license will show that you can afford to have kids. That's not American. We're not going to go down that path. Of course not. But the second thing I'd say is, no matter how much John wants to blame the parents, the kids did not cause this problem. The kids themselves are not at fault here. And the rest of us have to worry about these kids because they are our future too. So I'm happy to have John, you know, talk about the ways in which we could blame the parents. But here are the kids. They're with us now. And my argument is the rest of us have both an economic and a political and a moral obligation to worry about all these kids.
I want to come back and look at what you call a purple problem, but maybe it would be useful to make a little more real what children in this tier of our country's economy are up against.
Sure.
You know, in their daily lives, in their education, in their interaction with adults, in just the you've got a litany here of headwinds that they face that I think would be good to articulate.
Yeah, let me do that very quickly, Tom. It's true that the poorer kids increasingly face a family with a problem with the stability of their own families. And this is actually the one of these points that John was correctly emphasizing. There's been a growing gap in family stability between what I'm calling loosely rich kids and poor kids, so that by now only about 10% of the kids born to college-educated Americans, college graduates, are living in a single-parent family, whereas about 70% of kids born to high school-educated moms of all races, 70% of them are living in single-parent families. So there is, as John says, a big difference in the stability of their families. But more than that, and quite apart from that, there's a big difference in how much time and money their parents can invest in them. Used to be not much big difference in terms of the amount of money parents spent on, you know, violin lessons and daycare and trips to the zoo and so on. But now, after 30 years of growing disparity, the average working class family, the kid in the average working class family, it benefits from a little more than $700 a year, whereas a similar kid in a more affluent family gets $7,000 a year invested in his future or her future by their parents, as I say, in you know, piano lessons and soccer coaching and so on. The time that parents spend, what I call goodnight moon time, the time that parents spend interacting with their kids, reading to them and so on, used to be no difference between you know, rich kids and poor kids, and the amount of time that their parents spent with them, as I say, goodnight moon time. Now, the average kid in a college-educated home gets 45 minutes a day more intellectual stimulation from their parents than a similar kid in a working-class family. 45 minutes a day more means, because we now know what that means in terms of brain science, that the brains of young kids are being disproportionately helped if they're on the upper side of the opportunity gap, and not helped if they're on the lower side of the opportunity gap. So time and money, the quality of schools these kids attend are becoming more diverse, mostly, frankly, because of the growing economic segregation of our society, so that rich kids are increasingly going to school with other rich kids, and poor kids are mostly going to school with other poor kids. When the rich kids go to school, in their backpack, they bring their parents' aspirations. They bring their parents' cultural experiences and advantages. They bring their parents' money to help support extras at school. When the poor kids come to school, in their backpack, they bring gang violence and destroyed neighborhoods and family instability and so on. And as I say, you can see this in the data, but you can see it in the stories that we tell when we look at relatively well-off families and relatively poor families in the same school district. There are huge differences. These all add up to huge differences in the amount of education that kids complete. So that, in terms of college degrees, roughly 80% of the more affluent kids in America complete a college degree versus about 10% of kids coming from poor families. And there's a similar – there are similar charts in the book, as you well know, Tom, mm-hmm. showing that in terms of mentoring that kids get from neighbors, from church members, from other people in their communities, rich kids benefit. And what – as a researcher, I began to see was that lots of things that I hadn't even been aware of that my kids and grandchildren were benefiting from, that is, you know, parents talking to the kids when they're driving to soccer practice, that – actually does make a difference in the ability of those kids to move forward. And conversely, when a poor kid is sitting alone in front of a TV because his neighborhood's dangerous and his mom is out trying to eke out a living, the difference is enormous in the impact of that on their future. So this is not just a matter of my telling some sob stories. You can see in the data these growing gaps in virtually every aspect of things that affect kids.
Robert Putnam's new book is Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Isabel in Boston, thank you for calling, Isabel. You're on the air.
Thank you. What a fantastic show. This has really been on my mind the past few weeks. So this is just so timely. I couldn't agree more with Mr. Putnam. I see it every single day. I'm a stay-at-home mom. We are relatively well off. I am an immigrant. My parents had a third and fourth grade education in the country where we're from. Mm-hmm. And they worked in factories, and I made it through school. I got a degree in biotechnology. We live a very good life. My children, as a result, have access to iPads, iPods. They have access to the public library, which I drive them to. Because I have time to do that, I can pick up free passes at the public library. We can go to the Museum of Fine Arts, et cetera, et cetera. Many of my daughter's friends in particularly don't have access to any of that. Many of them come from single-parent homes. And something as simple as having an iPhone, I tutor a couple of sixth grade girls in math, makes such a huge difference. These girls don't have iPhones, so they can't scan the barcodes in their math books. So much of the books in school nowadays have barcodes, so that if you're stuck on a problem, you yep. take your iPhone or your smartphone, you scan it, a video pops up explaining it to you. These girls' parents can't even afford cable, Wi-Fi, much less an iPhone, while they're at work so that their child can figure out their math problem. And sometimes I sit back and I just think, how in the world are these children going to make it?
Isabel, you make it very, very real for us. Robert Putnam does the same in his new book, Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Want to come back and look at those differences, how we surmount them, why Isabel's parents, immigrant working-class parents, Robert Putnam, could boost her into a position of affluence, the American dream. But those around her today, it appears to her, and you perhaps cannot. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about a big, urgent case being made that America's children are in serious trouble. With Harvard heavyweight social scientist Robert Putnam, he says stark inequality of opportunity for kids is now deeply shadowing our country's future. His new book is Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Plenty of talk about this in politics. President Obama talked about it in his State of the Union address in January.
Will we accept an economy where only a few of us do spectacularly well? Or will we commit ourselves to an economy that generates rising incomes and chances for everyone who makes the effort?
Applause right there. Everybody getting in on the opportunity theme these days. Here's Republican Senator Ted Cruz just last month talked about income inequality at the America Recovery Policy Forum, Palm Springs, California. He said Democrats are to blame.
And I have to say I chuckle every time I hear Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton talk about income inequality, because it's increased dramatically under their policies.
Oh, boy. Suddenly, Republicans on the opportunity bandwagon as well and saying, hey, it's the other folks. Robert Putnam, I want to get into those politics, but I just have to step back first and say how appalling, how galling this picture is to me. You know, I grew up in a very well down the income ladder. But, you know, I was a white kid in a strong community with good schools at a time when you could rise and society seemed structured to help me rise. And I did. And what a marvelous thing that is to imagine being down there with all the rungs of the ladder stripped away, looking out on a kind of hopeless surrounding that you describe so many of these kids seeing. It just makes me crazy. That is not what this country is supposed to be about.
Yeah, Tom, I completely agree with that. And honestly, I think if Americans fully realized what's happened to kids at the bottom of the ladder, lots of people would be outraged. I think if we actually thought of these kids as our kids, and once upon a time Americans did think of everybody in town as one of our kids. When I was growing up, my parents talked, when they used the term our kids, they didn't mean my sister and me. They meant all the kids in Port Clinton. And we got to do something for our kids. They didn't mean we got to help Bob and Elaine. They meant let's figure out something that would benefit all the kids in town. Over the last 30 or 40 years, the meaning of the term our kids has shriveled so that now when people talk about our kids, they mean our biological kids. And you know, I'm not worried about that kid.
Is that because post-civil rights movement, the kids are of all different colors and racism still comes in here to play in a big way? You say it meant everybody in town, but there are a lot of towns where it didn't mean everybody. And you yourself talk about cross burnings in your own neck of the woods in Ohio. Was it really everybody? And is the problem now, how much of it is racially driven, that this sort of, they're not my kids attitude?
Well, Tom, I'm certainly not absolving Port Clinton of racism in the 1950s. That's, after all, I noted the issue of the cross burning and other serious issues of racism in Port Clinton. Nevertheless, in class terms, even those poor black kids in my class, as I've said, did pretty well. And of course, America has long had and still today has tremendous racial injustices, purely racial injustices. And nothing that I say should in any way say that that's false. It's just true. But it is also true that the growing gap, all of these increasing gaps that I show in the book are actually concentrated among white kids. The lower third of the population that we're talking about, the kids, I mean, non-white kids are disproportionately caught down there. That's certainly true. But most of the kids down there in that lower third are white. And so I certainly agree that we have to pay attention to purely racial disparities in American society, especially in the criminal justice system, as we've been talking about as a country since Ferguson. But I'm also saying this opportunity gap is not just about race. It's about all of our kids. And what's happened because of this shriveling, and no doubt you're right, that part of the reason that we have this shriveled sense of identity is because of racial intolerance.
Of course, the fact is if you let inequality go on too wide and too long, then color doesn't become the only issue. You can get back into old European-style issues of, well, they're not in our class. We thought of as aristocracy and otherwise. I mean, even within race, let me get our callers in, if I may. Tom in River Falls, Wisconsin. Tom, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Mr. Putman, I'm going to challenge you, so I'm going to give you a lot to chew on here. To me, this is a big elephant in the room. You keep talking about the last 30 years it all started crumbling. Well, chew on this, and I'd like to get your response. This is a result of the total dismantling of FDR's New Deal since the Reagan Revolution and the laissez-faire voodoo policies. Number one, corporate tax burden used to be one-third. They used to pick up one-third of the tax load during the prosperous years of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The wealthy carried a much larger tax burden. Number two, so-called free trade policies that benefit mostly the wealthy and multinationals, NAFTA, CAFTA, etc. Number three, labor union destruction since the Reagan Revolution over the last 30 years. Union participation used to be 30% of the workforce. Now it's 7%. You talked about no raises. Well, there it is. The productivity gains over the last several decades haven't gone to the workers because they've had no power to bargain. I lived in Western Europe for many years, and it looks like, mostly in Germany, it looks like how America looked like in the 50s, 60s, 70s, just what you were talking about, Tom. And why is that? Because they have 30% labor representation, Medicare for all, university system publicly financed, like all we used to have in America in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So those are the dots I'm connecting for you.
Tom, stand by right there. Robert Putnam, what about it? This didn't just happen. This is an active dismantling, our caller says, and he lays out the elements he sees as a dismantling. What do you say?
Well, I actually think there's a lot of truth in what Tom says. I'm a little surprised he thinks that what he said would shock me.
This a purple problem. That means to most ears bipartisan. But what he describes there was a political agenda. It's still going on in Wisconsin, where he's calling from. And just in the last week, there have been more anti-union steps unfolding. So it's not as though it's without political coloration, Bob.
Tom, an earlier caller offered a strong pink or a red interpretation of the problem. This caller, Tom, is offering a strong blue interpretation of the problem. In my own personal political life, I actually find Tom's a lot to agree with in Tom's.
But you're a social scientist and a political scientist, so we're asking for more than a personal assessment of what's going on.
Yeah, okay. And so here's what I want to say. I'd like, if we can, to have everybody see that this is a problem, and that if you focus on the kids and on evidence-based solutions to what would help them, I think that the facts will lead us inevitably towards the following kinds of solutions. The first solution, the most important thing we could do, as I say in the book, is to end this long stagnation of jobs and wages for people lower on the job hierarchy. And in that respect, I completely agree with Tom. And I think that unions were an important part of that. I actually talk about the role of unions in Port Clinton. So I agree that that is an important part of the solution. In addition, though, I think we have to also recognize the damage that has been done by many factors, but the damage that's been done to the working class family in America, which actually is really been destroyed. And therefore, we need to think about things like providing more help for parents. There are proven practical strategies for coaching parents to be better parents. There are proven practical strategies for investing in early childhood education. One of the things that I think is most important is that we know how we could improve the education in low-income schools. It will cost money, and somebody's going to have to pay those taxes. And my guess is that probably Tom and I would agree about who's going to have to pay the taxes that ought to be more invested in young kids. But
isn't that a political issue? I mean, Jason DePaul.
Of course, it's a political issue, Tom. For goodness sakes, of course it's a political issue. I'll never for seconds.
But it seems a bit elided. Jason DePaul reviewed your book very favorably, but then he says, you know, to frame inequality, as Putnam largely does, as a product of inadequate empathy and weakened civic institutions, is to overlook the extent to which it's also a story about interests and power. He says some Democrats protect moneyed interests, too, but it's impossible to understand inequality without understanding the power it gives those at the top to pull up the ladder. You're making a kind of an appeal to the heart. See all these kids as our kids. That's the title of the book. Isn't it as much political as it is empathetic?
Well, I'm actually not just making an appeal to the heart, Tom. I'm also, and I tried to do this before, making an appeal to the pocketbook. This is going to hurt everybody if we allow this to continue. But the more important thing is this. I think that the politics of America, it's of course a complicated story. And I and Jason DePaul wanted me to write a different book about how we got to the income inequality. There have been plenty of books written about that, and I agree with many of them. They've been written by friends and colleagues of mine. It seemed to me that there had not been enough focus on the consequences of the income gap, not the causes, not the political blame, but the consequences for our kids. And so this book focuses on what the consequences of this growing inequality and growing class segregation in America, what the consequences have been for all of our kids. Now, the politics of this, I take my inspiration politically, and I have a pretty clear political strategy. I may be wrong, but here it is. There have been periods in American history when calls to conscience have been combined with grassroots organizing to produce rapid change that had been seemed impossible just a few years or even a few months earlier. Mm-hmm. Take the Selma case that we're talking about now. I mean, that everybody's talking about now. Mm-hmm. 6 months before Selma, all the politically smart people said, we're never going to get voting rights and civil rights legislation passed in America because of the structure of the U.S. Congress. The folks who organized the Edmund Pettus Bridge March made an appeal both about the facts of inequality in the South and appealed to America's moral conscience. And it seems to me that appealing to the moral conscience of America combined with grassroots political organizing overnight changed the politics of that issue so that 6 months earlier it seemed impossible. 6 months later it was done. And I'm not, of course, saying that my book is going to be the equivalent of the eloquence of Martin Luther King. But I do object to the idea that the only way we can fix the problem is to argue about who's to blame for it.
Cynthia in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Cynthia, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm a teacher, retired teacher, and now I'm a special needs advocate in Gloucester and on the North Shore. And there's been a lot of conversation recently on NPR as well as other places about Adverse Childhood Experience, or ACE, which is a screening mechanism to sort of get a sense of the difficulties young children are experiencing. And as predicted, these issues are often more predicated in situations of poverty, and they consist of substance abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, and what's been proven is that the impact of these childhood traumas affects brain development. And so when you're working with children that are in poverty, and there's more and more of them all the time, we see this incredible difficulty in the classroom in reaching and teaching kids that have experienced these kinds of traumas, and it's becoming more and more frequent.
Cynthia, you bring the voice of experience to us right there. Forgive me, but we just got a couple of minutes left here. I mean, there's somebody right out of the teaching channel who sees the outcome here in kids and the tools that they're left with if they don't have the right kind of support coming up. How do we get over this hump? Because lately it's looked like we're just going further and further down this road toward greater inequality and a kind of tacit acceptance of it. And then people's interests, those who are on the lucky side of this, on the upside of this, their interests can come to seem invested in not changing it. You know, you quote one of those people living in the gilded housing along the beach. You know, if my kids are going to be successful, I don't think they should have to pay other people who are sitting around doing nothing for their success. How do we get everybody on the same page here, Bob?
Well, Tom, I'm actually trying to change the politics of this in the following way. First of all, I'm trying to get that woman on the shore in Port Clinton to see that actually, if we don't invest in those poor kids in Port Clinton, her own kids' future is at stake. That's the first point. Secondly, I hope that this issue, indeed the reason partly for the timing of the publication, is I hope this issue of the opportunity gap will in fact be a major issue in the forthcoming national election. And I hope we'll have a big fight about what are the best ways to fix it, because I think that would be terrific. And I have my own ideas about how we can go about fixing this problem. But I think the country would be benefited if we ask all of the presidential contenders this year, many of whom are now talking about the opportunity gap, so how would you fix it? And that's the way it seems to me a democracy does move forward. Of course, this problem is not going to be solved in Washington alone, certainly not alone. When we've had earlier episodes of big national reform in America, there's been a combination of a national conversation, which in turn then gives oxygen to lots of people in particular places, in New York City or in Boston or in Minnesota or in Port Clinton to figure out what we can do with big solutions like closing the economic income gap that we've talked about, and smaller solutions but still expensive ones like universal early childhood education, and with private solutions like providing more mentoring. These kids at the bottom right now, the most important characteristic about them is they're isolated, and that isolation is something that we actually all can do something about.
Robert Putnam says, reach out and mentor, do something. The country cannot go on this way. He writes it all up in his big new book, Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Robert Putnam, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks again, Tom.
Excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.